Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, efforts to woo Gulf Cooperation Council members on the Iran nuclear deal. Greek stocks nosedive. Reaction to new U.S. regulations on climate change. We'll hear about the keys to happiness.
The first key is to understand the true relationship between the conscious and subconscious areas of our mind.
And controversy swirls around the estate of the late singer Whitney Houston. It's all ahead on The Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been meeting in Qatar with his counterparts from the Six Nation Gulf Cooperation Council. Traveling with them is our own correspondent, Pamela Dawkins, who joins us on the line. Hey, Pam.
Hi.
Hi. Say, what does the Secretary of State hope to accomplish with this trip?
Secretary of State Kerry has several goals with this trip, but one of the main focal points is the Iran nuclear deal. Foreign ministers in the Gulf Cooperation Council have expressed concerns about the deal, and as well as about other regional security issues. But in particular, with the Iran nuclear deal, they've questioned if the additional revenue that Iran would receive as a result of the lifting of international sanctions would provide Iran with more funding to militant groups such as Hezbollah. They've also raised concerns that the deal could be destabilizing to their region because it could result in what they would consider an empowered Iran. Secretary of State Kerry is trying to address some of those concerns. His meeting with them here in Qatar is actually a follow-up on talks that were held at Camp David with President Obama. During that meeting back in May, Mr. Obama said the U.S. would deepen security cooperation and also hold more joint exercises and speed up weapons sales and help build a coordinated missile defense system.
Pam, correct me if I'm wrong, but the gist I get is that this is more of an exchange of views rather than anything concrete coming out of these talks.
That is true. That is true. It's more of an effort to address concerns. And at the top of the session today, there were also comments from the foreign minister of Qatar, who raised concerns about the Iran nuclear deal as well as other issues. The foreign minister said that the GCC hoped to achieve security, peace, and stability with the help of the United States. And he also spoke on other issues. One in particular was the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. He said the GCC was urging the United States to exert more effort to get the peace process back on track. He said the GCC was concerned that the process between Israel and the Palestinians had been what he called suffering from the failures and freezes, which he said were a result of what he called the Israeli occupation. He also spoke about the situation in Yemen, saying that the GCC was keen to achieve unity in Yemen. And in that country, a Saudi coalition has been helping the government battle Houthi rebels.
Now, this isn't Kerry's last stop. He's not coming home next. Where is he off to after this?
No, after spending time in the Middle East, in Qatar, as well as in Egypt, Kerry is going to turn his attention to Asia. His remaining stops are Singapore, Malaysia, and Vietnam. And on his agenda is attendance at an ASEAN summit. And also, he will raise regional security issues such as maritime security in the South China Sea.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Pam, and have a safe trip.
Thank you.
For more on how social media are covering Kerry's talks in Qatar, Michael Lippin joins us here in the studio. Thank you for coming, Michael.
Good to be here, Susan. Well, let's start with Kerry himself. He sent out a tweet a few hours ago saying that he had a constructive conversation with Qatari Emir Tamim before discussing the Iran deal with the GCC members in Doha. And he mentioned the Iran deal Twitter handle, which is one of the Obama administration's platforms for promoting that agreement. I've also been looking at what other reporters in Doha have been tweeting about Kerry's talks. One of them is Jay Solomon of the Wall Street Journal. His handle is @WSJSolomon, and he tweeted this: Qatari FM Khalid Al-Attiyah pressed the U.S. and Gulf states at the GCC summit to quickly resolve the crises in Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. Another reporter on the scene is the Associated Press's Matt Lee, who goes by the handle at AP Diplo Writer. He tweeted a link to the latest AP story on the Doha talks, saying Gulf Arabs welcome the Iran nuclear deal, but would like further assurances. When you click on his report, he expands on that point about assurances. Lee quotes the Qatari foreign minister as saying that Gulf Arab states would like further assurances that the U.S. will help them to counter what they see as increasing Iranian assertiveness in that region.
Well, Michael, have you seen anything else on Twitter about why the GCC remains concerned about Iran?
Well, I did see a tweet from Gulf News, which is the UAE's biggest-selling English-language newspaper. Its handle is at Gulf_news, and it has 306,000 followers. Gulf News tweeted a link to an opinion piece by a political scientist at Kuwait University. The tweet went like this. Opinion: why is the GCC skeptical about the Iran nuclear deal? In that piece, the Kuwaiti University analyst Abdullah Al-Shaiji writes that a new Gulf security architecture could emerge in which Iran has the means to be the region's hegemon at the expense of downgrading the Gulf state's strategic value. Susan?
Well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
New research from Australia's University of Adelaide is providing evidence that plants, which don't have a nervous system like animals, transmit animal-like signals when they're under stress. The findings show that plants respond to stress in their environment with a combination of chemical and electrical signals that are similar to those emitted by animals under stress. Senior author Matthew Gillingham, a professor at the Australian University, says that it's been long known that an animal neurotransmitter, GABA, is also produced by plants when they encounter stress such as drought, salinity, viruses, acidic soils, or extreme temperatures. The researchers made their findings when they noticed that a plant's neuroreceptors connected with its corresponding GABA neurotransmitters in a way that's similar in animals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Greek stocks dropped sharply today when the Athens Stock Exchange opened for the first time in 5 weeks. Business reporter Alexis Christophorus joins us on the line from New York with details. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Susan. Thank you. Well, investors ran for the exits today on the Athens Stock Exchange. The Greek stock market saw the most dramatic wave of selling in decades after the exchange opened for the first time in 5 weeks. We saw banks lead the plunge, falling about 30%. That's the daily maximum allowed by the Athens Stock Exchange. And the benchmark ASE index sank about 16%. That's after sliding as much as 23% earlier in the day. In all, Greek stocks have now lost more than 85% of their collective value since 2007. One Greek trader described the market as hell and a total disaster.
Wow. Perhaps you'll review for us why the Athens Stock Exchange was closed.
Well, the Greek government was forced to shut its banks and the stock exchange and impose capital controls in late June. And that was before ultimately accepting a deal for bridge financing to avoid default. And that happened even after voters, you may remember, on July 5th, rejected more austerity. Traders in Athens say that the stock market currently cannot function properly because of continuous halts as the prices plummet. They expect stocks in Greece to hit their lows in the coming days before the market can gain any semblance of normality. And also want to mention that a big number that scared investors today was a number that showed Greece's manufacturing industry shrank at a record pace last month as demand collapsed because of these capital controls we've seen taking place. Susan?
Well, thank you, Alexis.
You bet.
The White House is announcing new, tougher regulations, which will definitely affect the power plants that burn coal to create electricity in the United States. President Obama's Clean Power Plan would cut plant emissions by 32% below 2005 levels by the year 2030. Joining me with details on this environmental plan is International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. The new emissions plan from the White House and the Environmental Protection Agency would put in pollution limits about 9% lower than an earlier proposal. I spoke about this with Eric Pica, the president of the environmental advocacy group Friends of the Earth.
Well, first, this is a historic effort, a historic day. This is the first time that the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States is going to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Now, what the rule says is that we are going to reduce these greenhouse gas emissions by relying on renewable energies such as wind and solar, energy efficiency, as well as better pollution techniques to capture the CO2 that comes out of a coal-fired power plant.
Now, according to the information that I have, individual states will be responsible for coming up with their own plans to meet this target, but that under the new plan, they'll get two more years to do so, and it goes in effect by 2022.
Yes.
Do we have a potential problem with individual states coming up with their own plan?
Yeah, and so we will have problems with individual states coming up with plans, but also there will be a number of states, anywhere from a dozen to 20 states, that will try to sue the Environmental Protection Agency, saying that the EPA has overstepped its regulatory bounds and that they don't need to provide any plans whatsoever. And so we'll see a rash of litigation, probably starting today, but certainly over the next couple years, trying to oppose the Environmental Protection Agency's rule.
There has been rhetoric from Capitol Hill again and again and again during the Obama administration accusing the president of waging an alleged war on coal. Mitch McConnell, who is now the Senate Majority Leader, is one of the people who has used that phrase. It seems to be coming primarily from coal states. Could you amplify on that?
Yeah, and so, look, we have a problem. We have a climate crisis. Temperatures are warming. The last 14 years have seen the highest temperatures in the United States on record. And this is primarily caused by the burning of coal and oil. And if we're going to solve the climate crisis, we're going to have to end our use of coal. And so whether you call it a war on coal or a fight for our very existence on this planet, we have to reduce coal. And what this rule does is it says that we are going to reduce by 32% the amount of greenhouse gas pollution that comes from coal-fired power plants. And that means that we will be shutting down coal-fired power plants and we will be mining less coal in the United States.
I understand that a number of states may fight these new limits on carbon emissions in the courts. Some say this issue might wind up before the Supreme Court.
Coal is big business in some states, such as Wyoming, Kentucky, and West Virginia. Indeed, they may fight back, saying jobs and their economies are at stake with these new power plant pollution regulations.
Thanks for stopping by, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, pointers on switching that frown upside down, and the burial of her daughter setting a fire over the Whitney Houston estate. Feel like a gloomy Gus? The glass is always half empty. You can't seem to reach the sunny side of the street? Well, author Jim Jensen has some tips for you to change your life around, and he joins us now on the line. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Susan. Just a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. First of all, what is your first suggestion in your book, Seven Keys to Unlock Your Full Potential?
My first suggestion?
Yes.
Read it.
Okay.
The seven keys, let me talk about the first key. The first key is to understand the true relationship between the conscious and subconscious areas of our mind. These are not two different minds, but rather they're two spheres of the same mind. And most of us have been educated to understand that the subconscious handles our bodily functions. It grows our hair, our nails, will help heal a wound, digests our food. But many people are not aware that the subconscious is also a servo mechanism that works on our behalf 24/7, and it carries out what we command it and what the information we give to it by the conscious area of the mind. And we'll work just as hard to achieve something that might be negative as something positive. For example, we use a metaphor in the book to visualize an ocean liner going across the sea. And the conscious area of the mind would be like the captain who's up in the helm of the ship, barking out signals to the crew, full speed ahead, port starboard, 10 degrees north, whatever. And the crew is like the subconscious, which could be down in the engine room of the ship, below the water level, can't even see where the ship is going. And they just carry out the orders and say, aye, aye, sir, not minding whether they run the ship into the rocks, hit another vessel, or get it safely to its destination. So this is working, again, on our behalf 24-7. And therefore, it's not so important what we say to others or what others say to us, but it's extremely important what we say to ourselves.
That's a little trick I have when I have a really difficult day, several shows or something like that, and I wake up and I think, oh, no, I've got so much work to do. And then I just say to myself, hey, it's a challenge. You can do it. It'll be fun. And it changes your whole thing. It really is true. It's all in your head.
Exactly. The second key is the incredible power of our own self-talk. And again, although people, when I mention this, will be aware of this, they don't consciously think about it, that we, all of us, talk to ourselves all day long at the rate of 150 to 300 words a minute, over 50,000 thoughts a day, which is called self-talk. I mean, your listeners right now are talking to themselves about what they're hearing. They're assessing what they think about this. They're thinking about the rest of the day. What are they doing for lunch? Where are they going to dinner? I mean, all these thoughts that run through our brain. So again, as I just said a few minutes ago, that we need to be very mindful of what we say to ourselves. And when we catch ourselves, just like you say, gosh, it's a tough day or I've got too much. So wait a minute, time out, cancel. You know, it's a great day. I've got plenty of energy. I've got plenty of time. And again, re-instruct. The subconscious is like the hardware in a computer. And the conscious mind is like the software. It's just data input. We come into the world as a totally empty vessel. We don't have an opinion, thought, belief, attitude about anything. But through well-intending parents, older siblings, coaches, teachers, whatever, we get a lot of data input that begins to shape who we become. But the good news is we have the capacity to reprogram or change any of that data we want through the use of our self-talk. So those are the two kind of combinations of the relationship between the conscious and subconscious, and then being fully, fully aware of how we talk to ourselves. And then we have additional keys in the book that give instructions on how to properly do that and how to properly reprogram the subconscious.
Thank you, Jim. And tomorrow we'll have more on this subject with Jim and see if we can all make ourselves more happy. You're tuned to VOA.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Bobby Christina Brown, the deceased daughter of the late Whitney Houston, will rest next to her mother's grave in New Jersey. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Music's Ray McDonald about the mysterious circumstances surrounding the 22-year-old Brown's death and what will become of her mother's estate.
The world was shocked by the death of Bobby Christina Brown recently. She was found face down in a bathtub, very similar to her mother, Whitney Houston. Ray, this is eerie. This is really, really creepy. And January 31st is when they found Bobby Christina unresponsive.
Right.
And so now she's dead, and now it's like all the lawyers are trying to decide what to do with the estate because she was the sole heir to her mother's fortune.
That's exactly right. And beyond that, prosecutors want to try and figure out who, if anyone, was responsible for the death of Bobby Christina Brown, even though an initial autopsy showed no underlying cause for her death and no injuries.
Now, there was some question about a guy who was her half-brother or an adopted brother and then became her husband.
Nick Gordon.
Yeah, what's going on there?
Well, Nick's role in all of this is very nebulous, and I really can't say specifically that he did anything. I mean, he and Bobby Christina were together in her Atlanta area home. He found her face down in the bathtub on January 31st. As I say, the initial autopsy didn't reveal anything, although prosecutors are treating it as a homicide investigation. There will be more tests to come. Bobby Christina herself her funeral will be a private affair, and then she will be flown to New Jersey to be buried alongside her mother, Whitney Houston. This has yet to play out, and I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out.
And there's a lot of money at stake here. I mean, Whitney Houston, Bobby Christina was the sole heir of Whitney Houston's entire estate. Mm-hmm. Millions upon millions of dollars. Now, her grandmother, Sissy Houston, is still alive, as is her aunt. But according to Whitney Houston's will, everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust, I believe, right?
Everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust. And this is going to be a very tangled case. Legal experts are at odds over exactly how it will come out. But it's going to take a long time and a lot of money.
Now, where's her father, Bobby Brown, in all this? What role is he playing?
Well, right now, Bobby is just saying, you know, he's devastated by the death of his daughter. He tried to be at her side every moment that he could during her 6 months in hospital. I think Bobby is just so emotionally devastated right now that he really has yet to get his bearings.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. If you have any questions or comments about this, you can hit us up at VOA_music. That's our Twitter handle. You can also send a tweet to VOA_IE. Listen for Ray to count down the top 20 and the top 5 hits of the week. You can find that at www.voanews.com.
If you'd like to hear our program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department reviews efforts by foreign governments to combat human trafficking. The use of children as soldiers by nations and armed groups is an egregious form of this crime and is a special concern. While the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers is a global phenomenon, the 2015 Human Trafficking Report indicates, as it has in the past, that the practice is most critical in Asia and Africa. Children are often abducted, or at times sold, to be used as combatants. In addition to participating in combat-related activities, children are sometimes forced to engage in hazardous activities, such as laying mines, and are frequently killed or wounded. Some have been forced to commit atrocities, and most suffer psychological scarring. Both female and male child soldiers are often sexually abused or at high risk of contracting sexually transmitted diseases. In 2008, our nation enacted a law that requires the Secretary of State to identify countries that have governmental armed forces or government-supported armed groups that recruit and use child soldiers. The law requires that the Secretary of State compile and publish a list of those countries in the annual trafficking report. These countries then face legal restrictions on access to certain types of U.S. military assistance and training. 8 countries were listed this year: Syria, Burma, Sudan, Somalia, South Sudan, Nigeria, Yemen, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listed last year, the transitional government of the Central African Republic and Rwanda are making progress to reduce the recruitment and use of child soldiers and weren't included on the sanctions and restrictions list. The sale and trafficking of children and their entrapment in any form must be eradicated, and their unlawful recruitment for labor or sexual exploitation in conflict areas must be stopped. All nations must work together with international organizations and non-governmental organizations to take urgent action to disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate unlawful child soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.